I think lying to old people is really fun. Episode of Jabber on the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. You are Richard Wally from Portland, Oregon.
And you are Cassidy Robinson from sunny California.
Mm-hmm. And this week we will be talking about Magic in the Moonlight and The Giver. And at the end of the program for our Netflix homework, we will also be talking about Escape from Tomorrow.
You're speaking really slowly.
I am?
Enunciating. Yeah. Why?
Just making sure that I don't slur anything unintentionally.
I think I know why. I don't think we're... I think we enunciate better. So I think that that's pro in our... And now I start enunciating.
Yeah, we enunciate so well. There's this character. You might hate me a little bit for saying this, but there's this character that Fred Armisen does on Saturday Night Live.
Sure.
Or used to do. I don't know if he's even on it anymore. But he, the gag is he's this guy who like reads newspaper ads on the Weekend Update. Or not ads, but headlines. And he's like supposed to be a satirist. But you can tell like he is, the character hasn't really come up with anything to say about anything.
Right.
So he just like reads the headline and then like begins to say something and goes to like 30 opening statements before he like commits to a sentence.
Sure.
And it kind of reminds me of you sometimes. Especially when I'm editing the podcast and I take out like the, so you see, I mean, yesterday I was thinking if you come around to it and then eventually you get to what you were actually trying to say.
It's because I'm ADD. You know, it's really funny when you make fun of people who have, you know, things, Cassidy. You know, like the other day, I was thinking, thanks a lot.
No, I know exactly what it is that your brain is already like five sentences ahead, so you have to back up to that point.
I've already moved on, yeah. That's the problem. See, a lot of people don't get that in context with me when they first talk, so they're like, man, he's just all over the place. And
yeah.
I am. I truly am. But yeah, you get used to it.
Well, I'm hopefully it's one of our endearing qualities, but if you want to make fun of me, I'm going to give you some ammunition. Here it is. I have an anecdote. The other week I was driving around Garden Grove and I was looking for a new coffee place because I don't really love Starbucks. I'll drink it because it's close to my house and there's one about every 5 feet. But it's not my favorite. If I'm in the mood, I want, you know, Starbucks is so dark and it gives you heartburn all day and it's not my favorite. So I figured I'm in a big city. Like there should be a decent coffee place somewhere if I look for it.
But you're in Orange County.
Yeah. And I open Yelp on my phone and I look for a few places. I drive to one. And they were closed on whatever day that was, or they closed at a certain time in the afternoon or something ridiculous. I'm like, okay, well, I'll look again. If there's nothing close, I'll just settle on Starbucks. And there was one like a couple miles away. And I was like, okay, it has a pretty decent star rating and it, you know, only shows one price signal. So I drive there and I stop and I walk in not really thinking about it. It's like, oh, yeah. GZ Cafe or something like that. And as soon as I walk in, it's like this huge open room. It's like way too big just to be a cafe. And the desk is at like the very end. It's all like darkly lit and there's like televisions everywhere and like lounge chairs. And I'm like, what? Am I at the right place? And then all of a sudden this like Vietnamese girl in nothing but a bikini starts walking around me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of looking around, and I go back outside for a second to look if I'm under the right thing, because it's like in a strip mall, like everything is here.
Right.
So maybe I walked in the wrong door, and sure enough, I'm at the cafe, and she looks at me, and she's like, "Hi, do you want to take a seat?" I'm like, "I just came here to get coffee. I think I'm going to get it to go." She's like, "Are you at the right place?" I'm like, "I think so." And she's like, "You don't look like you are." Like, you're probably right. So I walk all the way, but I'm like, I'm there now. I might as well just at least order to go. So I walk awkwardly to the front where the desk is, and I'm like, "Can I just get like an iced mocha to go?" And the girl who was sitting at the counter, who had a little bit more clothes on, was like, "Oh, well, we don't really have that. We can make like this." She started hazelnut, blah, 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 blah. And she's like, "It's way better than Starbucks, I promise." I'm like, "Okay, I guess I'll get that." And I'm just standing there. Like, I don't want to take a seat. I don't know. I was completely, totally uncomfortable. You know, because I don't mean this to sound racial, but when it comes to certain Asian ethnicities, until they're about, with girls especially, until they're about 35, they look 12.
Sure.
And so I don't really know what's going on at this establishment. You know what I mean? I don't know, is this like human trafficking thing? I don't know.
Do Asians, do they all human traffic? Is that what you're trying to tell the world?
I'm just saying I was not where I thought I was going to be.
You know what I think's always funny is when you're all racist on the podcast all the time.
That's me. That's my thing. But so I order it, and then eventually she's like, "Okay, so it's however much, probably too much." And I hand her my card, and she's like, "Oh, we only accept cash here." I'm like, "Oh, okay, well, I'm just going to go." So I'm sure I like sprinted to the door because I just was like so uncomfortable by the entire thing. So that's the story about how I accidentally walked into a bikini coffee joint.
I don't even understand. Like, I mean, that sounds dangerous. Like, wouldn't you, like, I mean, if you're not, you don't have a lot of clothes on and you're making coffee, couldn't you potentially get coffee on your skin? It would burn.
I don't know. I guess you have to be careful. You have to walk around really careful. And there's like, you know, it's like the middle of the afternoon. So it's probably not even its most hopping, you know, hours. And it's a pretty big room. There's maybe like 12 or less guys who were kind of sitting alone. They weren't even with like colleagues or friends or anything. They're like individually sitting at different booths, just kind of gawking. And it was weird. I'm just so not that guy. I like the idea of strip clubs and that just like does nothing for me. I don't know.
I don't know. I thought your story was amusing, so you get that. Now I'm all self-conscious. Thanks.
I didn't fuck you up for the rest of the...
Yeah, I'm done. I'm
duration of this podcast. Don't worry about it. I got your back. I got you. Well, what's the first news story you have for us then?
Okay, so Vin Diesel, a couple weeks ago, he started teasing because Marvel brought him in. Were they really bring him in just to do a big talking tree? Mm-hmm. And... so he posted a little bit, "Oh, I've been going back in and I've been talking to Marvel."
Is that your Vin Diesel?
That's my Vin Diesel. That's as good as it's going to get. And, yeah, so they're thinking I'm Inhuman. And so he left some kind of, seemingly cryptic, but not very cryptic thing at all.
Yeah.
About what they might be interested in him for. So
kind of like The Rock with the Shazam.
Yeah.
Just say the word.
Barry Bastard. Yeah. No, but he said that, and then basically a couple weeks later, a Collider, a news article site that I'm fairly into, they posted a thing about, that they're moving forward with this Joe Robert Cole script that they've been sitting on for a while, and they're pretty happy with it. And the speculation is that it'll come out sometime around the second Guardian of the Galaxy movie.
Mm-hmm.
So, specifically, I don't know. That sounds like it, you know, how they produced Guardians of the Galaxy makes a lot of sense that they're moving into the Inhumans.
Yeah, you know more about the Inhumans than I do. What's their deal?
So
isn't that like headed by Black Adam?
That is. Black Adam doesn't speak. He's the king ruler. What's kind of interesting is how they kind of approach this, like Game of Thrones kind of. I know that means nothing to you, but basically there's a lot of political intrigue and infighting between the actual characters. But what it is basically one of the races that we were introduced to in Guardians of the Galaxy, the Kree.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Ronan the Accuser, the big baddie of the movie, was.
Yeah.
In the early days of the human race, they came down and they started experimenting upon them with this stuff called the Terrigen Mist that kind of mutated and started having adverse effects and giving them powers, basically. And so basically there was a lot of humans that had these superpowers kind of innate in them.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't come out until they're exposed to the Terrigen Mist.
Yeah.
And so that's what the Inhumans are.
Okay. And so are we thinking that maybe Vin Diesel's been approached for Black Adam, or is there a character you think he would fit in better with?
Yeah, I think Black Adam. What's funny about Black Adam is Black Adam does not speak at all.
So they really want Vin Diesel, but they just don't want him to talk.
Yeah, pretty much. Which is interesting because, I mean, he was a character that was a tree that said three lines, and that's it, basically.
Yeah. Said one phrase the entire movie. Yeah.
Yeah. And now they want a character that doesn't speak. No, I mean, it makes sense, and I see why they would pick him for that character. It's just, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, okay.
I wonder what he thinks about that, though.
Well, I mean, I think he's a very physical actor anyways. I mean,
yeah.
Our favorite part of the last Riddick movie was that first 45 minutes.
Where he doesn't talk.
Where he doesn't talk. He just fights monsters. So to me, it's like, yeah, that makes sense. I like that.
Yeah, fair enough.
I mean, it's as weird as all the other cosmic Marvel stuff.
Yeah. Well, now they know that works. Like, before, that was a big gamble. Could they really leave Earth?
Yeah.
And now we know they can, depending on the script, the director, all the cast, all of those things, like usual. But we know there is a precedent that it can work. And yeah. I think, the way I framed my review when I reviewed Guardians of the Galaxy is the success of Guardians of the Galaxy has less to do with people's interest in Guardians of the Galaxy, more to do with people's faith in Marvel Studios.
The Inhumans to me has always been super serious, and so I don't know, it would definitely have a different tone.
We'll see. All right. Sony might bow to North Korea's dictator and edit The Interview. This is the movie that starred James Franco and Seth Rogen, the plot to kill Kim Jong-un. We talked a little bit about how Kim Jong-un did not react very kindly to the idea of this movie, saying he's going to retaliate mercilessly and all of this stuff. And now it looks like first they changed the release date. It was supposed to come out in October. Now they've released it to a Christmas release date, which only said to me they have more faith in the movie now than they did before, because I think of all of this news stuff related to the movie, it's giving it more hype. Mm-hmm. So now they feel as though it could be a Christmas release. So I was like, all right, they're really putting their money where its mouth is as far as that goes. But the fact that the studio, Sony, does want to trim some things here. Now, I don't know if it's going to be a total thing like they did with the Red Dawn movie by turning the characters from Chinese to North Korean.
Right.
Or if they're going to, like, change, you know, go back in and dub over every time they say Kim Jong-un and call him something generic. Or I know specifically there's these buttons that the North Koreans wear on their uniforms. That's like a tribute to Kim Jong Il. And I know they're like digitally erasing those.
Yeah, they are. That's the one thing that the article did speak about. The other thing that they said, they were moving it because there's a really apparently very violent scene in the movie,
mm-hmm.
and Seth Rogen isn't sure how they want to make sure they get the best version of it on, apparently, and they're not sure how it's going to work. I don't know, that kind of, maybe that was just smoke, but
it's the more and more I hear about this movie and more I read about it, it's like, this isn't going to come out. Like, there's no way this movie can actually come out. Like, this is going to be the Seth Rogen, James Franco, the clown who laughed, you know, the clown who cried, the Jerry Lewis thing that he never released.
Right. I was like, what? You know, I don't think so, though. I think it's going to be released in December. I do think it's a weird choice that they moved it there. So you're saying because they like have a lot of faith in it, I guess they
well, do Christmas
coming
is
out
a,
around Christmas.
Yeah, Christmas but... specifically is a very, 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 maybe the most competitive day to release a movie because you have all these family movies coming out. You have all of these like, you know, tentpoles and all of this prestige pictures. And in the middle of it, they're going to release this silly comedy.
Well, I guess they're going to doing the, see, the other thing too, is maybe they're just trying to do counter programming.
Yeah.
And so they're saying, maybe we can, you know, get around this if we do some counter programming. So I don't know. We'll see. I'm not that invested in it. I more found it funny that,
Oh, that I think the news stories surrounding it are vastly more interesting than this movie will ever be.
Agreed. So that's why, I mean, I was more amused when Kim Jong-un was first like, we're gonna, you know, blow up the world because you made a movie.
Yeah.
So that's where I'm kind of at with it.
And I actually, I, you know, if we really want to get into it, I think that the, these edits have less to do with the studio's worry of offending North Korea, who's not going to be allowed to see the movie anyway, and more to do with the other foreign markets that might have some tie to North Korea, like China.
I mean, maybe. Maybe they're just counting on, well, nobody really likes North Korea. Maybe that's, I don't know what their thing is, really, yeah. But... I guess we'll see. I don't have a lot. I don't have a lot to speculate because we have talked about it before.
Yeah. So, well, what's your next story?
My next story is they're making Michael C. Hall is to star in a unproduced Stanley Kubrick miniseries called God Fearing Man. It's apparently about a Canadian who stole $16 million in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually more interested. I mean, it is Michael C. Hall, the Dexter star.
Yeah,
and he was good in it. He really is. He's a good actor.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more into it because of the Stanley Kubrick angle, and I'm kind of almost interested. I'm like, oh, what would a, you know, Stanley Kubrick miniseries look like? One, two.
Yeah.
I mean, are they going to put the faith and dedication in it and try to do their own thing? What's the reasoning behind doing it now?
So. Mm-hmm. Stanley Kubrick is becoming the Tupac of dead film auteurs. Like he just there's all this content that just keeps coming out. First it was AI, and now the Shining prequel, and then this, and then eventually someone's gonna make that Napoleon movie, you know it. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Michael C. Hall's cool. I wasn't really a Dexter guy. I never really cared, but I loved Michael C. Hall in 6 Feet Under. He's my favorite character. And I know he's a talented actor.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, sure, I'm down. Do we know what network is planning to do this?
No, it does not say.
So they're probably still shopping it around.
They are. Specifically with this project, I guess, I don't know. I guess what's interesting to me is a Stanley Kubrick bank robbing film.
Mm-hmm.
He liked to play in genre, and it's some of my favorite stuff of his when he played in genre. And so this is something we didn't see. We didn't see the crime element from him that much.
You could go all the way back to his first couple movies, The Killing, Killer's Kiss, a little bit Lolita. But yeah,
not in his later years though, once he kind of hit his peak, you know. So
yeah.
I don't know. It's interesting to me from that standpoint. And you said, "Oh, he's like Tupac Shakur," but AI came out like shortly after his death.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, basically he died and it was being made, he died and then it came out.
Yeah, but if you think about it, there's just all of these, everyone's like trying to find all these unpublished things that he did, or all, you know, his notes or ideas, and he kept very, very detailed descriptions of how scenes were going to be shot and everything, so they already kind of have these blueprints for these projects that never got made.
Well, I mean, that's what's interesting in the fact that, I mean, he's kind of come around almost posthumously after he's died.
Yeah.
More people have been like coming into the cold of Stanley Kubrick.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. To me, it's more the whole, it's the crime element that I'm interested in. I want to see what a Stanley Kubrick crime thing would look like.
Well, I don't know if we'll know what it looks like, since he's not going to be directing it, but with the not being alive anymore thing.
But what are the ideas coming through is more...
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, heaven knows, whoever takes it is probably going to, you know, put on the Stanley Kubrick goggles and direct it as he thought Kubrick would have. I mean, we can guess anyway. I don't know. Okay, well, let's go ahead and get into the pet topic. And this week is my turn, and I thought that I would kind of go more biographical.
Okay.
So both of us kind of worked in and around film growing up. You know, our first, like, real jobs.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
Yes. I mean, I worked a lot of odd jobs, but...
Not like growing up in the film industry.
Not like the industry with, you know... But, you know, when we were living in Idaho, the first job you ever had was working at a movie theater. And then after a couple odd jobs.
Technically the third job I had, but it was my big first
grown up job.
It was my paying first for rent. Grown up job, paying yeah. rent, all that kind of stuff, right?
And then later on, you ended up working for the movie theater as a manager over at Idaho State University for like, what, 3 years?
I worked there the whole time I was in school, so I was 4.5 years, but I was manager for like 2.5 or something like that.
Mm-hmm. And I worked at a video store.
Assistant manager.
I worked at a video store for about 4.5 years as well, putting myself through college most of the time. And that was the job still to this day that I've held the longest. And I was driving around with some friends down here, and we were talking about movies as we usually do. And I was talking about something, and I was doing that thing that I do, that I think a lot of people do, but I tend to do a lot. This movie's that meets that with this sprinkled in.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, I don't know, they were kind of, I don't know if they're questioning me or complimenting me where I get this uncanny knack to do that. And I'm like, I don't know, probably from years working at a video store where if I wanted to recommend Mulholland Drive, I had to sell it in a way that, would be understandable to people who weren't aware of David Lynch or surrealism. So I had to say, well, you know, it's kind of like this TV show mixed with that music video and whatever. And they were mentioning how, you know, because of the death of the video store industry, that that's going to be a dying art, if you want to call it that. I think of it as a lazy shorthand. I actually try to edit out of my writing. But what do you think your history in working with film, as far as, you know, being a bit working at a theater, promoting movies and projecting and all of that stuff, how do you think that has influenced you as far as the way you view film and maybe in a more practical sense?
You know, since I worked at a theater that basically had one of the last, you know, well, that's not true. 35 millimeter is moving out.
Yeah.
And regardless of the purists and stuff like that, the fact is that at the business end, it's becoming less viable and it's becoming more antiquated. It just is. And it's sad. I agree. I think that there should be a place for it in repertory houses. And I think that there still is in larger cities.
Mm-hmm.
However, the problem is, it's more than just like, oh, people don't want that anymore. It's that they're not making parts for those, for old 35 millimeter projectors. There's all you can do is maintain it and hope it doesn't break.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty, you know, when a part broke in the machine, we were pretty always really scared because we didn't know if they'd have a used replacement part.
Mm. Not,
we couldn't buy brand new. We had to specifically use old parts that they found used.
Yeah.
So, I mean, so that's one thing. So I have kind of, so what it's kind of instilled in me a little bit is kind of a reverence for the older machines or something. I like that weird whirring sound because I worked up there. And, just being in an auditorium in general. The other thing is it's made me kind of particular about watching films with people. Because I got to watch films like literally by myself sometimes in a huge auditorium. And so sometimes I'm probably a little meaner than I should be about talking during movies.
Yeah.
But only barely. But I've gotten it. I've slowed down on that a little bit. You know, whispers don't bother me as much anymore. But in general, just kind of it sounds dumb, and I'm not trying to come off as kind of hokey, but it is true. I just kind of have a general, you know, awe and kind of reverence of a theater. Now, dealing with the public, I mean, it's impossible, you know, because I also got to do some of the, it's kind of like this meets this kind of thing.
Yeah. But
you also learn, like as much as, you know, movie people want to talk about, like, well, people should like old film. A lot of people don't. You know,
yeah. Did you guys really show that many older pictures? I mean, and sometimes you would show like something like Fight Club or whatever, but did you ever show anything?
Yeah. We showed things like Streetcar Called Desire. We showed, you know, I would say a lot of 70s film. I would consider that old now.
Yeah.
Even. We tried to show a lot of those. It didn't work, you know. I mean, some of it was also advertisement.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't advertise well enough, but. We tried to show the original Last House on the Left.
Yeah.
No. I think we got like 7 kids.
And they were probably scarred for life. That is a rough flick, especially if you don't know what you're getting into.
You know, I specifically tried to do a counter programming. I'm like, you have to, you know, really sell this as...
an exploitation film.
Well, not just exploitation, but also a anti-Valentine's Day movie.
That's what you were doing it as?
I was trying, yeah.
Oh my god. I mean, like, you could totally pull that off in like LA, Cinefamily, New Beverly, something like that. That would go over really well. But in Pocatello?
I wanted to. You know what? As much as we talk about it, there is kind of a crowd for that. But there was a really lazy crowd for that. So
yeah.
If you couldn't pull them out of their houses, they pretty much weren't going to come.
Yeah.
But no, yeah, I did try that. I thought it was amusing, at least. I actually put it on there as a joke because I thought people would tell me no.
You sick man.
I know, right?
I didn't know about this. I would have went.
No, it was advertised. You were in school. It was up there.
Maybe I thought, like, I saw it on the program and just assumed that it was going to be the new one.
We put the dates by them.
Huh. Weird.
So, I thought that they would tell me no. That was, like, a joke.
Yeah.
And then they put it on the calendar. I was like, uh-oh. I might get in trouble for that.
So, in some regard, you even have, like, a minor experience on, like, what it would be like to program a festival. When you never did that, like, outright. But that's kind of in the same ballpark.
Well, yeah, I mean, we had to... The other thing about... I don't know, it was kind of strangely antiquated and didn't make a lot of sense, but... So we had to print our calendars. And to print them the cheapest, we had to print them, you know... I guess I have kind of an idea of kind of the practical end of movies, like when you're selling them and stuff like that. It's not... You know, it's not, oh, we can only be creative and people will get it. It doesn't work that way sometimes.
Yeah. That kind of gives you, I would say, kind of gives you insight into, you know, we talk a lot about release dates and counter programming and, you know, what does it mean that this, you know, we were just talking about with the interview, what does it mean that this comes out at this time versus that time? And so I think that also informs that as well.
I think maybe you're, I mean...
You think I'm reading into that, or...?
I haven't thought about it, but maybe, because, I mean, I have noticed that sometimes I'll go into the kind of the business end of things, and it's not something that I just really have thought about, but maybe that's why.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm like, oh, maybe they're trying to go at it at this angle.
Yeah.
Because there is only so many ways to try to get it to market, and you are breaking through a lot of white noise.
Mm-hmm.
And people are a little less kind to theaters than they used to be, so...
Yeah. Well, I'm working at a video store. I mean, this might sound kind of cheesy, but, you know... Famously, Quentin Tarantino worked in a video store until he could raise the money to make Reservoir Dogs. And eventually get himself out of the video store. And a lot of people kind of talked about how, like, that's his film school. He never went to film school, but he learned by watching and blah, blah, blah. And it's a thing that even he kind of makes fun of as far as this narrative that's been built around his celebrity. But he talked about how it wasn't his film school, but it was more like his Village Voice. You know, somebody could come up to him and he could argue why they should rent this, that, or the other. And he gets to be, you know, the tastemaker.
Right.
I would say working at a video store, that's definitely had a lot to do with when my interest towards film kind of spiked. I mean, I always had a general interest of it. I was always kind of a movie geek to some extent, but I started thinking a lot more seriously about pursuing criticism and these kinds of things after I worked there. Not necessarily correlation or causation, but maybe more correlation.
Mm-hmm.
But you do definitely start to think a lot more in terms of, well, this movie's really good, but it's not renting that well, but this one is terrible and it's renting very well. And how do you argue one against the other, or how do you, and, you know, I would try and do things like, you know, a thing that I implemented in the video store was, employee picks. Cause you go to a lot of like record stores and that kind of stuff, and they always have like the employees all get to pick some things and display them and say, you should check this out. And, it was kind of a thing that kind of sort of took off. I, you know, if I'm allowed to pat myself on the back, people really liked that idea. And I really was able to get people to rent things that they never would have before, like a Michael Haneke film.
Yeah.
Or Last House on the Left or whatever. So I think that, definitely kind of, influenced, sort of the way I think about movies in a big way.
No, I mean, it does. And I think it just gives you an appreciation of, and it kind of exposes you to things that you might not have. The one good thing about working at the ISU theater was they would bring in like weird foreign docs from like Oscilloscope and other stuff like that when I was first working there. And
yeah,
I saw the original Let the Right One In. Is that the Swedish title?
Yeah.
Okay, I got the right one then. But no, I saw that when it had only had a theater release at that point. So,
mm-hmm.
You know,
you're exposed to more, and yeah.
Well, you're exposed to more, and you're just around it. You know, even working at like a Carmike, which was the first job you had mentioned,
mm-hmm. Which is like a chain theater and not a very good one.
I mean, what's interesting is we were exposed to even things like The Sleepover. You know, you end up watching crap that you would never, ever watch on your own. But you're like, let's do this.
So do you remember that?
Yeah, I do remember that.
Not only we had a private screening the night before because you were testing to see if the reels were put together right.
Right.
We'd get to do this every once in a while. And I was just your roommate at the time. I wasn't even working at the theater. But It was me, you, Keith, who's been on the show, and our friend Chris McElpring. And the four of us in like a 50-seat theater watch this tween movie starring the girl from Arrested Development and Steve Carell before he was a thing.
Yeah.
And it's a terrible movie.
Oh, yeah.
It's really bad.
I can't remember what happened, but I remember having a good time, so.
Yeah, it was fun to make fun of, and I'm pretty sure that's why we did it, but that's a special memory.
Yeah. So it just... this is where we get nostalgic.
Yeah. Well, let's go ahead and get into our reviews. And I'll start here with a little review for Woody Allen's Magic in the Moonlight. This is his film this year. He's been going strong since mid-70s, making a film a year. And last year he had kind of a surprise success with Blue Jasmine, which garnered some awards attention for Cate Blanchett, who played the lead. And this movie is a little bit lighter in tone and style and ambition. And basically, it's a period film that takes place around the beginning of the I want to say the 1920s, 1924, or something like that. And it stars Colin Firth, who plays a stage magician named Wei Ling Su. He wears this, like, Asian garb that makes him look totally ridiculous and, you know, very kind of yellow face type of thing. And he makes elephants disappear and, you know, simple tricks like sawing a girl in half or, disappearing, reappearing acts, those kind of things. Things that we all have seen the tricks of the trade to now, but at the time blew everyone's mind. And he's kind of this grumpy, middle-aged skeptic, like diehard skeptic. He, you know, he believes in science and everything can be explained and there's a trick to everything and there's no such thing as miracles. And his, he moonlights, I guess, as sort of being a defrauder, and a friend of his, an ex-magician, invites him down to this small town where this girl, played by Emma Stone, is running around telling people that she can talk to the dead and predict people's futures. And his friend, who used to be a diehard skeptic like himself, says, "She's convinced me. You have to come down here and see what she's doing. What's the trick?" And they kind of get to know each other, and he spends a lot of time with her and trying to look for the strings or look for whatever it is. And the more and more he tries to disprove her, the more and more he keeps running into this wall of, well, I can't explain this. So what does it mean to life and faith and the existence of God and the afterlife and all of these things he never really considered before? And of course, it also kind of brings into attention the dynamic between the two. It kind of becomes a little bit of a romantic comedy. Like I said, this is light Woody Allen. This is not, he's not trying to change the world. He's not trying to reinvent the wheel. We've kind of seen this type of stuff even in his body of work before. I would say this is kind of more along the lines of Midnight in Paris, Woody Allen. Although even with, maybe with less ambition than that. It looks really nice. Darius Kanji, the cinematographer, who works a lot with David Fincher. He works here, and it looks beautiful. Period setting, costume, all that stuff's really nice. Colin Firth is quite good as the stiff upper lip British aristocrat snob. And he gets a lot of funny dialogue. He just, you know, he has no problem telling everyone that he thinks he's a genius and that everyone can only gain from being around him or listening to him or suffering his criticism. And there's a lot of that of Allen obviously sort of criticizing himself and the public perception of himself. You know, he often writes himself into his lead characters, and he's certainly doing that here and poking a little fun at the perception of his kind of distance. And obviously, you know, Allen has always been a huge fan and supporter of Ingmar Bergman. And there's a lot of themes here that has to deal with faith and the questioning of faith and the afterlife and these kind of things that Ingmar was always really, really interested in. And you see these themes, like you could kind of almost do a double feature with this movie and The Magician, because they're kind of similar in some ways. It's almost his like light romantic comedy version of The Magician.
Okay.
And it's good. It's totally solid. You know, a lot of people are kind of bagging this because it's not Blue Jasmine, and it isn't Blue Jasmine. It's not even top tier Woody Allen, but it's totally solid. It's funny when it should be. The acting is pretty good. Colin Firth is really funny, and it at least has ideas. It maybe it's nothing nobody's ever thought of before, even Woody Allen, but it's totally solid. I think if this wasn't Woody Allen's Magic in the Moonlight, everyone would be a little bit more positive about it than they are. I liked it. It's a solid B.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know. The themes sound interesting to me.
Yeah.
Even if it has been done before, even by him. So.
Yeah, no, it's...
What is another film that he's done that's...
Kind of deals in this sort of thing? Well, yeah. I don't know. If you look... A lot of his more kind of... strange films or movies that kind of walk out of reality, like Midnight in Paris or Purple Rose of Cairo. I just watched the film Stardust Memories, which is basically his 8.5.
Okay.
Those kind of movies, I think, deal a little bit in some of these themes of sort of like, what does it all mean? And this one's maybe a little bit more explicit about that, maybe even to the point of being on the nose. But I think it's totally fine. I'd much rather watch Woody Allen on half cylinders than most people on full.
Okay.
Okay, well, let's get into the movie we both saw, which is The Giver. And I'll let you set that up.
Okay, so The Giver is based on the young adult novel. It was one of the first
everyone's read but me.
Yeah, I read it the first time. I think I was like in third or second grade or something like that. Mm-hmm. It surprises me that you haven't, because it was really being pushed on us at that age because of the whole whatever the young adult, whatever the kid award is for books.
Yeah.
I just remember the silver stamp on the book. Maybe mm-hmm. it's also a Pulitzer. I don't know. Anyways, it does have some fame built on it. And I think around a few different generations, too, because apparently I didn't know this, but I guess it's actually became a series. There's two other books within the, I don't know what the series is called, but
yeah,
this book is essentially about a utopian / dystopian society where everything is seemingly perfect.
Mm-hmm.
But then things kind of are put in a different perspective and it seems less so.
Mm-hmm.
To be less vague, specifically, you have a lead character who they're basically given jobs on their
society
gives them jobs on their 18th birthday. In the book, I think it's like at like 12, but in the movie, it's like 18. Mm-hmm. So basically, you're given this job, and one of the kids, the lead character in the movie, is given a job that he has to be the receiver. He basically mm-hmm. has to get like all the knowledge and memories from the old world, from the old society when there was like feelings and hurt and not feelings but emotion, excuse me, they differentiate that. And it's sort of interesting. The, mm-hmm. the film itself, I at first was kind of I was a little hesitant towards it because of the look. The look has a very CW, everybody's very beautiful, very the lines are very straight and clean and everything.
Yeah.
However, I will say that the look ends up kind of, I was very hesitant at first because of that, because I was like, okay, they're going to just make another one of these kind of films.
Yeah.
And actually, I think the look works for it because of what the subject matter is. Now, it's dystopian light. I don't think it's like if you've seen any other kind of dystopian stuff or whatever, it's not going to blow your mind. But I think that it's kind of, I think the subject matter is interesting, and I think that it's fairly well done. And mm-hmm. For the age range, it's kind of pointing towards, I think it is pretty good. Because The Giver, the book itself, I think, is dystopian light. I read it the first time, and it did sort of lead me into these other kind of novels and these kind of ideas, you know? It led me into liking things like Fahrenheit 451 and or movies like Brazil or things like that.
Yeah.
Or even, you know, Blade Runner or another book, Anthem, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually think it's a great way to kind of get kids into thinking about things and thinking about the world and society and getting kind of into ideas mm-hmm. more than... And I think it still does kind of work in our... I think some of the weird, like, little technological updates and things like that, I think this book is kind of timeless in the sense that it kind of does... Can kind of present this, like, don't just, you know, take in what people... The desanitized thing that people give you. What is actually there? What has actually happened?
Yeah.
And it is important to know these things. And so I ended up actually kind of liking the movie. I don't think it's great. However, I think that is good for what it's trying to be.
Agreed. Agreed. I would say my biggest knock on it mm-hmm. is the lead here, played by Brenton Thwaites. I don't know. He was the same kid who was in Oculus. And I believe I said the same thing about him there. He's kind of blank. There's not a lot really coming from him. Now, for the first half of that movie, that's kind of fine, because everyone's a little blank. Everyone's a little Stepford. There's, you know, black and white utopia. The movie switches from black and white and slowly moves into color as he is given more information about the old world through Jeff Bridges, who plays the Giver. Okay, first of all, like, the log line of this movie, you could pretty much say, is there's an older man called the Giver, who sits really close and holds a younger man called the Receiver and shares special secrets with. I'm just saying they didn't think that out, really.
It might not have been on the top of their mind at the time period it was written, no.
But that aside, no, yeah, agreed. Same, kind of the same thing. It's so weird. This movie, I saw this movie and Magic in the Moonlight the day before because they're kind of thematically the same. Like, they're both movies about enlightenment, and they're both movies that basically the message is comfort of ignorance is not as important as the hurtful reality.
Right.
And I think they're both not brilliant by any means, but I think they're both totally solid. There's a little bit here in the middle. The movie feels kind of skimming the surfaces a little bit of their ideas. And there's a little bit here, like, where kind of I'd been more interested to kind of dig deeper. It decides to kind of show things in montage, like his progression into knowledge. Okay. His enlightenment is kind of briefed over.
Right.
And it sort of seems at one point in the movie he's a noob, and by two scenes later he's ready to take on a revolution. And I feel like there's a little bit of middle stuff there that's more needed to make that character arc more convincing. A little bit of that is his acting as well.
Agreed. I don't know. I don't really, I think that the choice of making it kind of, as I kind of said, and I've liked some CW stuff, so don't get me wrong, but like, yeah, but specifically that CW-ness, I think that you would be still sort of blank if you kind of, you know, you came from this kind of world and then all of a sudden you received knowledge about Vietnam. Like, I don't think that you would necessarily, the first time you experience the idea of war. So yeah. I actually don't think, I don't really discredit, I think the blankness is fine. I think that it was better casting than anything. I thought that it made sense. I don't know. I can see what you're saying. It does seem to kind of jump forward a little too quickly.
I don't think I appreciate it being a 97 minute movie, but
I think it could use maybe like a 5 to 10 minute more scene to kind of give you a little bit more.
Yeah.
Or maybe even go into the bee stinging thing a little bit more and kind of try to explain to him what is pain a little bit more than just like, oh, that's pain.
Yeah. Well, and also there's this character that kind of drifts in towards the middle. I want to say it's played by Taylor Swift, of all people.
It is. It is played by Taylor Swift.
And there's this little bit of history about her, and it's kind of briefed over. And I feel like there's more going on there thematically than it could tie in probably a little stronger than it does. But, you know, Jeff Bridges and Meryl Streep are both pretty good in this, as you would expect them to be. Jeff Bridges may be phoning it in a little bit more than Streep. But, no, I enjoyed this, and I thought that it was, for this kind of movie, if we're comparing it to, like, The Hunger Games and The Maze Runner and the whatever the next thing's going to be, Divergent and all of these dystopian teen movies, I like the fact that this one looks different than those and structurally is different than those.
Well, and I think, honestly, I think it's a bit smarter than those.
No, I mean, obviously that kind of comes from the source material, which was like this well-renowned book. It's not just YA stuff, but it's...
It was a YA book, too.
And at the time, yeah.
But I haven't read Hunger Games, so I'm not gonna, like, say whatever about the book itself.
Mm-hmm.
However, you know, I will say that I think this is, you know, we were kind of talking about this earlier about the public perception versus, you know, trying to convince somebody.
Yeah.
I think this is much better film than the first Hunger Games.
Oh, by far. Yeah. I actually prefer this over the second one. And I haven't seen a lot of these little Hunger Game ripoffs that have come out lately, but I think Philip Noyce, who's the director who also did Clear and Present Danger, Rabbit Proof Rents, The Quiet American. He deals in a lot of these kind of espionage thrillers. But I think that he is a really solid workman director, and he knows how to make a film look good. And he's been around the block long enough that he understands the nuts and bolts of storytelling and filmmaking. Right. And his confidence comes through in even kind of lighter material like this.
Yeah. No, it is. It's just a solid, for what it is, kind of movie. I mean,
yeah.
we're not talking awards and we're not talking this is like
the favorite thing
or I'm going to buy it or anything like that. But what I'm saying is...
I was totally entertained and enthralled for the most part.
Yeah, and I think people should see it. And honestly, I think it's a good movie to show kids. It really gets you start to thinking. The whole experience made me think a lot about the book, you know, made me think about the first time I got the book and
reading it like the first time. Yeah.
So, and it's a good way to, you know, oh, did you like this movie and stuff like this? Well, maybe try the book. So I think that there is a lot of merit in this movie.
Yeah.
On those kind of fronts. And so,
and it's visually experimental. It's not like wildly experimental. It's not really, you know, challenging anybody, but I think that it is, it's at least visually interested in trying to tell things with tone and you know, the color palette actually has a narrative theme to it. And that's interesting for a younger, geared movie. Mm-hmm. Now, if you'll let me, can I wear my, bedwetting liberal pinko communist hat?
Sure, go for it.
You can definitely tell, and I've never read the book. Like I said, I think I'm the only person who hasn't, but you can definitely tell that the author of this material was definitely kind of coming up during Cold War time. Because everything about this dystopian future is like the American paranoia of communism.
Which many of them were.
And living in the day and age, it's a little hard to swallow some of the ethos of this movie when living in the day and age that we live now, where you just turn on Facebook to see how your friends are doing, and you can't help but read about Ebola and Gaza and military strikes in the middle of Missouri right now, mm-hmm. and gas explosions in Siberia and all of this crazy shit. And I can't help but think, like, here's this little society who everybody gets a job. Everybody is, you know, for the most part, healthy and treated with respect and comfortable. And I'm not seeing the downside to some of this yet. Now, obviously, like, taking injections so you can't feel love or have, you know, physical affection, that's a problem.
Well, but the ethos is there isn't one without the other. I mean, that's old. I mean, the duality of beauty and ugliness is an old philosophical idea. It's not like...
No, yeah. I'm just saying there are... The argument against communism, which this movie I feel is very strongly about, I feel some of it is a little bit... paranoia. Like if communism gets out of control, we're gonna start, you know, controlling, it's gonna be thought police, and we're all gonna, like, everyone's gonna have to be the same, and music will be outlawed and all of this stuff. And I just, there's some of that where I'm like, I see what you're saying, especially at seeing as this was written in 1993, just right after the Berlin Wall fell. But like, I can't help but juxtapose this movie with our current world insanity and think there's some of this paranoia is a little unfounded, but that's just me.
I think you're reading into
wearing it my bedwetting liberal pinko commie hat.
Yeah.
And I don't think says anything about the movie. The movie itself, as a science fiction film, fiction with, you know, if you're really treating it as that, it is totally solid. It is fine.
Okay. I don't know what to do with all that, but yeah, sure. No, I think personal opinion, since we're going into opinions, I think you're reading into it too much. I don't think it's
try to read into it that much. It was kind of,
that doesn't mean just because you didn't try to read into it doesn't mean you're not reading into it too much. I think it's just as much you could read it as kind of being like, you know, just because you can't ignore the world, you can be apathetic if you want, but that doesn't change the situation. And specifically with the babies and stuff like that, I think you can read it just as much as kind of the difference between Facebook activism and actual activism.
No, that's true.
So I think it depends on your read, and I think you're reading into it a little too.
I don't think it's that difficult. Wise. I don't think it's that difficult to come to these conclusions.
I don't think it's difficult to come to those conclusions, but I don't think that it's necessarily the intention or what it's about.
No, I think ultimately it, you know, by the end of the movie, once you see what the whole picture is and everything. Also, I mean, if we're going to go into like movie stuff, it's kind of a deus ex machina that's sort of annoying about how this gets resolved, but that's neither here nor there. As far as the thematic gesturing goes, but sure. But it, I don't know. I that all aside, I think this movie is pretty smart. It's really well made, not amazingly acted, but well enough to get you through. It does what it says on the tin. Yeah. So I'd say it's worth a look. And nobody's watching it, by the way. This is like number 6 in the box office.
I know. That's why I guess I find it a little sad, because I kind of feel like this should garner. I do think it should garner a little more attention than
Expendables 3.
Expendables 3 or Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yeah.
Even, I mean, I don't know. To me, I did see some kids in the theater, so that made me happy. But I don't, again, I think it's more about the thought. I don't think it's necessarily, to me, it's about a governmental system. I don't think it's specifically communism. I think it could be specifically a dictatorship. It could be specifically a republic, which we are in the United States, not a democracy. So I think you're a little off in that. I think it's more stands for a government in general. So,
All right. If you say so, let's go ahead and get into our Netflix homework now, which is another black and white film called Escape from Tomorrow. And I'm pulling that up as we speak, because I don't know anybody who's involved in this. This is written and directed by Randy Moore. This premiered last year at Sundance with some amount of buzz behind it, because a lot of it was shot at Disney World without their permission and shot on a small DSLR camera where they're stealing shots and eventually assembled this around some stage stuff in hotel rooms and whatever. But basically the story is there's this middle-aged family, this man named Jim, who learns early in the morning before he's taking his family out to Disney World that he has been fired from his job. So it kind of puts him in a weird funk, and him and his wife are arguing the whole time, and they're trying to get on all the rides. And, you know, as they're going, showing these sequences on the rides, it occurred to me like, oh, they would have had to ride this ride at least 5 or 6 times to get some of this coverage. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for what that's worth. And as they're there, all of these weird things start occurring. He's kind of chasing these two teenage French girls, and following this fantasy. His wife, starts to have these weird hallucinations. So does he. And it all kind of sort of not really ties together at the end. I don't know. Basically my feeling of the movie is if you ever wanted to see National Lampoon's Vacation meets Eraserhead, this is the movie for you.
But not as good as either.
Either of them. No, I have to say, I didn't really care for this much at all.
No, I thought it was a lot of hype. Cool for them for going all gorilla on Disney. But I actually think that I was actually interested in the first like third of this film.
Yeah, me too. When they were portraying the surrealness just through camera angles and that kind of stuff, and just kind of shooting it surreal rather than putting in all this stuff in post, like making people's faces melt and do weird things. And it just gets into complete absurdity.
And well, that absurdity doesn't work at all.
No,
it's not sold. It kind of comes out of left field, and it's not just the weirdness that bothers me.
Yeah.
Cause that doesn't bother me at all. Actually, when all the like on when he's on a Small World and it's all making scary faces at him, that part I was into.
You know, yeah, I didn't mind that.
If they were just going for, you know, it's really that they kind of overjumped the shark.
Oh yeah, they jump over like 5 sharks.
Yeah,
and yeah,
that's the problem, is they try to oversell the weirdness and they didn't need to. You know, I guess what I give it credit for is I kind of at first was into the ideas of the film, but
what ideas? Because I don't know if I ever could figure out what it was trying to say.
Well, at first maybe I'm wrong. At first I thought it was trying to be like that whole like this is, you know, I think it was more of a contemporary, this is what family, you know, trying to sell it through, you know, Disney, this is the American whatever, the Americana kind of
perfect family,
yeah, kind of dissolving kind of thing, and what's happening now. But then that's just, I feel like that's like completely like thrown out the window by the end. And
well,
maybe
it's completely
they...
buried by all of these weird story threads that never really congeal. Like all of a sudden you're bringing in like robots and aliens and witches and
yeah, and I don't I feel like it masks those things, and like the cat flu and all those kind of things.
Oh, I forgot about that. That's just like, that's what I'm talking about.
Well, that's the kind of stuff that didn't work. It could have worked if you would have done it on a much smaller level, like you were with the faces in A Small World. They just oversold it, and what it ended up, instead of illuminating the ideas, it masked the ideas. And I think by the end, it kind of, because of the mask, the ideas didn't come through. Again, to me, it's not like this like oh my gosh, kind of like blow your mind kind of thing. It's just this kind of like, oh, this, you know, at first I was like, oh, they're doing the kind of disillusion of families and kind of the breakdown and what, you know, it's talking about like a husband that cheats on his wife and kind of what it does to the family and things like that and where it comes from. And it plays at who's that everybody kind of has a part to blame, at least husband and wife oriented does. And kind of, and so it does some interesting things, but completely amateurish kind of film stuff kind of ends up drowning all that.
Drops ball completely by the middle of the movie and drifts off into nowhere land, and it never really recovers. And it keeps, rather than like bringing things back, it just digs its heels deeper in its surrealness. You can kind of, the way I felt about it is they stole all these shots, and then they realized they didn't have enough for a film.
Right.
So they, rather than going with what would have been a better idea, which is just to imply a surrealness of Disneyland, you know, shooting it in black and white, so you strip out all the color, and the quote-unquote magic, and kind of making it look imposing, which was interesting. And it's actually, for the most part, shot pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Not acted particularly well. Pretty amateurish.
Pretty poorly
there. But,
yeah.
But fine for a low-budget thing. But then once the more and more leaps it starts taking with the characters, and once it starts introducing all of these strange ideas, I just lost it. Continually lost more interest through the film.
Yeah, I got, as soon as they started taking the bigger leaps, I pretty much was done with it.
Yeah,
I got pretty bored. I was checking the time. And...
Mm-hmm, me too. And it felt like by the middle of the movie, it just wasn't ending. Like it felt, it's not a long movie. It's like an hour and a half, but it felt forever long because it was just so going nowhere.
Yeah. And again, I the ideas were there at first, and they just, and I see what you're saying. I think that was maybe part of the problem, is they started at Disneyland. Mm-hmm. And then they shot some at Disney World. They probably got kicked out or discovered or something.
Yeah.
Or they just didn't get enough shots.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I was wondering if it was at both, because there was stuff because I just went there. There was stuff I specifically recognized. I was like, wait a minute, where is this Disneyland or World? Because it showed Epcot at the beginning. And so I looked it up and I was like, oh, I guess that's Disney World. But yeah, I wondered if they used from both.
I think they had to have.
Yeah.
Well, I watched it with a Disneyland expert, my wife, and she definitely was like, no, that's Disneyland, that's Disney World. And she'd point out why it was different or what made them different. I was like, oh, okay, cool.
Well, there you go.
But I think Disney is a wonderful punching bag, and it's easy to go for, but I don't think that they...
Well, there is stuff like when I went there, there is stuff that is weirdly creepy about it. If you look at it in a certain context, like It's a Small World is kind of a weird ride.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's really slow. It drifts you through these weird kind of racially reductive areas, you know, where they portray this is what the Far East looks like and this is what cowboys and blah, blah, blah. And there's something about it that's almost kind of World's Fair creepy about it. It just is, especially when you know that Walt Disney himself was like a hardcore xenophobe. He gets that a little bit towards the beginning. I don't know. I just kind of think this should have been like a short film, like a 40-minute experiment.
And it shouldn't have gone. Yeah, there are certain things that it just didn't work with it.
Yeah. I mean, we've already
mentioned them, but it just dissolves. And I'm more speaking. You're speaking on the filmmaking level, and I'm speaking on the idea level.
Yeah. Both. Yeah. I mean, the themes, whatever were kind of hinted at, completely fly away.
Yeah, and it because of the filmmaking, it dissolves those things. And so, what I'm saying is if you're going to use something, if you're going to do Gorilla whatever at Disneyland, and then you're going to use them as a punching bag, but then kind of lose it that way, it actually kind of looks... that's another way that it kind of loses its potency. It's like, okay, so you kind of undid everything you've already done.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even think I could really recommend this to people. I don't think it's very good. I don't think people... I don't see the point in recommending it.
Mm, yeah. I mean, it's... Again, it's sort of audacious in the stealing shots aspect of it, and they were able to get out of it. But it's ultimately
that becomes gimmicky and a shtick to me.
Yeah, yeah.
I couldn't recommend it as a film to people.
No, not really me either. I'd say if you did see this and liked it, I would say go watch some David Lynch. Go watch some Guy Madden. Like, this is not that good.
Yeah,
even on surrealism, like it's kind of.
Is Guy Madden the Donnie Darko guy?
No, that's a Richard. Oh fuck! Now I can't remember his last name.
Well, anyways, even something like I'm not even way into Donnie Darko, but even something like that.
Well, those movies have a little bit more of a purpose. They know what they're doing.
Yeah,
and they have an end game. You know, as much as people want to say movies like Mulholland Drive and Eraserhead make no sense, they make their own dream logic sense. This movie doesn't really... This movie leans on those ideas to get away with the fact that it didn't have a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't really know what he's doing with that genre. And it's not informed by the history of cinema. It's just informed with, well, we have 40 minutes of usable footage. How do we make a story?
Sure.
Which he didn't really even bother to do. So, yeah, no, it's not that good. Next week is going to be our 100th episode, and knock on wood, hopefully we're going to have on Leland Brungart again from Dampercast, who's going to celebrate our 100th episode with us, and he has asked us to review the movie Sophie's Choice for next week's Netflix homework.
Yep, Sophie's Choice.
So we're doing it. We're taking on Sophie.
We're going full Holocaust.
And if anybody has anything to say about anything that we talked about in this episode, Magic in the Moonlight, The Giver, Escape from Tomorrow, or Sophie's Choice for next week, or you just want to leave us any kind of general feedback about the show, you can do that at our email, jabberonthedrone@gmail.com. We're also looking for new ideas for pet topics, or points of discussion, anything really. Yeah. You can also contact us on Facebook, facebook.com/jabberpodcast. You can follow us on Twitter @jabberpodcast. You can find us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio or Pocket Cast and listen to us on your favorite mobile device. We're also on Tumblr. I don't know. It's there. If you're on Tumblr, you understand more about it than I do. And you can read my movie reviews that I do every week for the Idaho State Journal, saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. You can read Richard's stuff that he does at his blog, rdwally.weebly.com. You can read some of the content I provide for the Seattle-based entertainment site MacGuffin at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. And be sure to check out the new episode of the Quarterlife Crisis. So until then, we'll talk to you next week. Talk to you later.
Okay. Have a good one. Bye.
That's it.